Welcome to Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith. In this episode, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Richard Orlandi, Professor of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, and Chief of the Division of Rhinology and Sinus Surgery at the University of Utah. They will be discussing the ICAR document. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by an educational grant from Intersect ENT, developers of the Propel Mometasone Furoate Sinus Implant. Propel is the only FDA-approved, bioabsorbable implant designed to prop open the post-surgical ethmoid sinus and gradually deliver an advanced corticosteroid directly to the sinus lining over 30 days. Propel is clinically proven to improve post-operative outcomes by reducing the need for additional surgical procedures and systemic steroids, and is the only product in sinus surgery backed by Level 1A clinical evidence. Please visit www.propelopens.com for further information.
Well, hello, hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm your host, Tim Smith, and I'm joined today by Dr. Richard Orlandi, who's a professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at the University of Utah, and is the chief of the Division of Rhinology and Sinus Surgery there. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, listen, Richard, first of all, congratulations on just an absolutely Herculean effort in terms of putting together this document, this international consensus on allergy and rhinology, particularly related to rhinosinusitis. We'll call it ICAR. Does that sound fair to you?
That sounds great.
Okay, good. So, first of all, Richard, let's just dive into some of the more controversial aspects of all of this, since that's what people primarily want to hear about. So tell me about what you think of as some of the more controversial aspects of ICAR.
I think that there are a couple. One of the ones, as we went through, that we found was this idea of appropriate medical therapy prior to recommending sinus surgery. And we've, in the past, called that maximal medical therapy. And with some evidence that's come out recently that looks at, is delaying surgery and whether that may actually be detrimental to some patients, we decided to, first of all, choose the concept of appropriate medical therapy rather than maximal. But what happened is we looked at that, we really tried to balance what we felt was really the strong need to make a statement on this issue. What is appropriate medical therapy prior to surgery, and balance that with really the paucity of evidence on this issue. And so we clearly need to do a lot more work on this and really define what is appropriate prior to recommending surgery. And I think it's going to be controversial when people read through that, because there are some fairly strong statements, yet the level of evidence is quite low. And so we're hoping to maybe spur some more research in this area.
I was going to say, just commenting on that, I think, moving away from the term maximal towards appropriate just seems to make so much more sense in this day and age, because what is even the best medical therapy for one group of patients with chronic rhinosinusitis is just different than it is for another group of patients with what we're calling the same disease process, even though we realize that it's not exactly the same disease process. It's just falling under this umbrella of chronic rhinosinusitis.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of the recommendations throughout the document suffer from that, in a sense that most of the studies that we were looking at in this really systematic evidence-based review apply to all chronic rhinosinusitis or all acute rhinosinusitis, and we know that those disease states differ from one patient to another, one group of patients to another. I think one of the other areas that, not surprisingly, is going to be somewhat controversial, and was controversial as we put the recommendations together, was about image guidance in sinus surgery.
Yeah.
Lots of opinions on what's the, that this is really the best thing for patients, but we have to be honest about the level of evidence. As we put this together as authors, we had quite a robust discussion about what really the statement should be, and of course, this is an area that's not going to probably improve with more evidence because of the ethical and frankly, statistical issues trying to define what is
best. Explain that, Richard. Explain what you mean by that, statistical and ethical issues. How are those going to prevent us from doing the appropriate study?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think that what you have to look at is the risk of complications or the completeness of surgery or the improvement of outcomes. And
yeah.
So because the risk of complications is so low, it takes an enormous number of patients in a study to show that there's a difference with or without.
And I've seen some sample size calculations for studies like that where you would have to enroll literally thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of patients in order to have, you know, appropriate power to show a difference in complications with image guidance or without image guidance.
Absolutely, yeah, tens of thousands, I agree. And so, and then there are ethical issues. Most of us believe that image guidance is beneficial. And so you have an ethical dilemma where if you think something is beneficial, how can you then randomize a patient to not receive it? And so there's this clinical equipoise issue that many of us at this point believe it would be difficult to do any sort of a study like that where we have thousands and thousands of patients. And also the difficulty, of course, of comparing apples to apples. So I think image guidance is one of those that's going to remain controversial, and we're just not going to be able to fix that.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. What else did you find controversial?
Probably the biggest controversy was the one around recommendations around drug-eluting implants. And this one actually, we actually were not able to come to consensus on a recommendation among the authors. It's the only area within the entire document where we could not come to consensus. And it really wrapped...
When you say we could not come to consensus, who is this, the entire authorship on the paper, or how do you... Was it the group that was working on this particular section?
Great point. Thank you. And I probably should have mentioned that. So the way the document was put together is there were groups of authors that were assigned to each particular topic. And then ultimately, the entire document was reviewed by all of the authors. But this is one where the group initially could not come together. And a few more authors were brought in to try to come to consensus. And it was just found that we couldn't come to consensus. There were issues, but it really is, it's two balancing issues. One is the evidence is high-level evidence. It's grade A-level evidence, but the amount of evidence, quantity of that evidence, is very small. And so, and we have very limited experience as a field in this area, so it was hard to make a generalizable recommendation. And clearly, this is an area that more evidence is going to help us going forward.
I think, to your point, it's almost, like you said, the evidence is in place. We're always asking for the highest level of evidence, right? And we've got these randomized controlled trials with this particular technology. It's the experience factor that I feel like is still developing and evolving. I know it's still developing and evolving for me in my practice.
I think so, and I think many of us felt uncomfortable making a strong recommendation or any sort of a firm recommendation with the amount of experience we have so far. And so it's a quality of evidence versus quantity of evidence issue for now. And, you know, this is something that more and more data is coming out, and we're certainly going to be revisiting these recommendations going forward.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. A little bit paradoxical, an area where we have the highest level of evidence, it's hard to reach consensus on what to recommend, right?
Exactly. Not what we would have necessarily expected, but, you know, looking back through the process, not surprising either.
Now, there were several areas in the document where recommendations were made against therapies. So, obviously, we've been talking more about recommendations for certain things. There were areas where the document makes recommendations against. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, so this was an interesting thing. So again, we have to remember that the data that we looked at really looks at broad groups of patients. There are this incredible variation in acute, recurrent acute, and chronic rhinosinusitis, as we all know. And so it's important when we looked at making a recommendation against something, a lot of our authors felt that this was going to be concerning, that people are going to misinterpret what that meant. And so to be clear, and we tried to make this as clear as possible in the document, when we make a recommendation against something, we're just asking a provider to pause and say, you know, do I really want to do this? Does the evidence really back this up? But then take that individual patient and the clinician experience and wrap that together to truly what is evidence-based medicine. This document's not a cookbook. We don't have that level of evidence to provide a cookbook for each individual patient clearly. And so we don't want anybody to think that a particular therapy is contraindicated or violates a standard of care or shouldn't be reimbursed for or anything like that, because it's done at odds with this consensus statement. The recommendations are that. They're just recommendations. And we just ask that people consider that as they're employing therapies and to make the best evidence-based decision for those patients, for each individual patient.
So if someone looks at their practice and they see that they're using something, for instance, let's take antifungals for chronic rhinosinusitis, because I think there was a recommendation against their use. Is that fair?
That's correct.
Okay. So let's say that someone's using antifungals routinely in their practice. When they read this document, really the way they should interpret that is, well, wait a second. They're recommending against antifungals. I'm using it on a fairly regular basis. What is going on here? And they need to examine their practice, their patient population, their outcome, and understand that the broader literature suggests that there really isn't great evidence to support their current practice.
And actually some evidence that would indicate that the risk-benefit ratio mitigates against it. But again, just as you said, maybe there's something special about their practice, their patient population, where they are geographically, what they're seeing, that would make that a reasonable option. We just ask that people, you know, take a second look at that and think it through and say, you know, should I really be doing this? Is this really beneficial for my patients?
I mean, you and I both know, I think you know, I know that there is this very small subgroup of patients with chronic rhinosinusitis in my practice that appears to respond to antifungal medications. Do you have that in your practice?
I do, and I think the same could be said for topical antibiotics and a number of the other things where we had a recommendation against. And, you know, I'll tell you, like you, I think I'm going to continue to use some of those things in selected patients, even after having scoured the evidence, because in one or two or whatever patients, there is going to be the benefit outweighing the risk. But what we're saying is globally, overall, that is not the case.
I think there's some concern that third-party payers will use these recommendations against to say to us when we're prescribing, let's say, an antifungal or a topical antibiotic, in that unusual case, they'll say, well, you're practicing against the recommendations from ICAR. So how do we manage these types? Whenever we set out to write things down like this and we try to be very transparent in the way we're thinking, we're at risk for these types of unintended consequences. So how do we go about managing that, Richard?
We tried very hard within the document to address this very issue. Clearly, we don't want a recommendation for or a recommendation against to be taken out of context. We literally spent paragraphs within the introduction addressing this very issue and explicitly saying that evidence-based medicine is to take a recommendation and to apply it to an individual patient with the individual patient situation and the individual provider's clinical expertise. ICAR or any other similar document is not a cookbook for an individual patient. So I think the way to address that when the issue comes up, and I'm sure it will come up, unfortunately,
Yeah. Is
to not take that individual paragraph of a recommendation for or recommendation against out of context, but to see it in context of the methodology of the document and specifically in what evidence-based medicine really is. And so there's something internally within the document that an individual can point to and say, look, you're taking this out of context.
Right, right. No, that's good stuff, and good for us to all keep in mind, and probably applies to so many things that are coming out, not just within the rhinology literature, but within the entire scope of otolaryngology, consensus statements and practice guidelines, and the fact of the matter is, these don't apply to every single patient in our practice. They should apply to the majority, as theory would have it, but they don't apply to every single patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree completely.
So what do you think has the potential to be the most misunderstood aspect of ICAR?
I think really that issue that we just discussed, which is, you know, because ICAR says I should or shouldn't do something, that's not really how this should be interpreted. It's based on the current evidence. Here's what we think is the best thing for this group of patients. But the practitioner has to, you know, I mean, we're not robots. The practitioner has to take that and use his or her brain and experience and to apply that to the patient. So I think the temptation is to cookbook this or did create an algorithm, and we had concerns about that because, frankly, there's a lot of variation. But it's a template that we very much can deviate from and should deviate from in the individual patient when we have good, thought-out reasons to do so.
Fair enough. When you look at the document, what would you say is the most surprising aspect of the document? Anything come out of this that you said to yourself, wow, I didn't expect that?
Yeah, I think that going in, and one of the principal reasons that I wanted to do this document was to really put together all the best evidence that we have. Now, going in, I think we would all say we knew the evidence was not going to be robust in all areas. In, again, not just in chronic rhinosinusitis, but in a lot of areas of acute rhinosinusitis, recurrent acute exacerbation of chronic, and so forth. Having said that, I was actually most surprised by how poor it still was. And even common practices that we use that have been discussed for years, that we've all been taught, that we have taught others, have little or no evidence to back them up. So prolonged non-macrolide antibiotics, using a non-macrolide antibiotic for chronic rhinosinusitis for more than 3 weeks, for instance.
Like doxycycline, for instance?
Well, or even just like if we're trying to treat the patient gets better after a week or two, let's treat them for 4 or 6 weeks stamp out that bacteria. And there's just no evidence to either support or refute that practice. And so it was interesting to me. I knew we weren't going to have great evidence on a lot of areas. Having said that, it was surprising to me even still how the paucity of evidence in some areas. Now, some of them are great. When you look at the use of intranasal corticosteroids topically, very robust data in chronic rhinosinusitis.
Yeah.
And so there's some areas that have quite frankly been overdone. And so we're hoping that this document, which really we took pains with evidence tables and so forth to really demonstrate what the evidence was, we hope that this will actually spur individuals to start asking these questions in a structured way, and hopefully when we do this again in a few years, we'll have some more robust data to work with.
Yeah, it's interesting about the antibiotics, and antibiotics have survived long courses of antibiotics for whatever reason have survived now for decades in terms of the management of this disease. But at the same time, as I talk to people around the country, I find that people are using fewer and fewer antibiotics to treat the disease relative to 10 years ago, certainly relative to 20 years ago. And I even find the odd practitioner, not that they're odd necessarily, but the outlying practitioner who says, I never use antibiotics in my practice for chronic sinusitis.
I agree completely. I think that more and more we're understanding that chronic rhinosinusitis is an inflammatory more than an infectious disease, that the sinuses aren't supposed to be sterile. We know more about the microbiome and so forth. And, circling back to what we initially talked about, this really became an issue when we were talking about what's appropriate medical therapy before taking a patient to the operating room for chronic rhinosinusitis without nasal polyps. Is a trial of antibiotics, is there data to support that a trial of antibiotics or even a prolonged non-macrolide trial or however, non-macrolide shorter trial, however you want to say it, is that appropriate or and necessary prior to recommending surgery? And we had a very robust discussion about that because we all kind of felt that it was, but when you appeal to the evidence, there's not a lot there.
Yeah, and I think it's really great to shine a light on that because there are some historical documents where it is written that, unless someone has failed 3 or 4 weeks of a broad spectrum or culture directed antibiotic therapy, that they're not a candidate for sinus surgery. And that was, admittedly, that's the way I was practicing some 15 and 20 years ago, but that practice, at least for me, and I think for many of my colleagues who I talk to around the country, that practice has probably changed more dramatically than any other practice that I can think of over the course of the years.
And I agree with you, and I think that this is a way where the ICAR document can actually help us interface in a more positive way with third-party payers, where we can begin to look at some of these requirements and some that we as otolaryngologists have helped produce and say, you know, there's actually not a lot of evidence to say that every patient has to get X, Y, and Z in their treatment before moving on to the next step. And frankly, there we may be in a, either in an individual sense and in a population-wide sense with overuse of antibiotics, we may be doing more harm than good.
It's a point very well taken. So, Richard, let me ask you one last question before you and I break away to the rest of our day, and that is, how is this document really different from other similar types of documents that are published out there?
That's a great question, Tim. I think that really it goes to the methodology. When we set out to write this document, we really did everything possible to rely completely on the published literature and not on our own opinions or our own experiences or as authors. And so at every step, we really looked at how can we eliminate expert bias or the bias of expert opinion and conjecture and what we've been taught for 20 years and what we've been teaching for 20 years and really appeal to the evidence. And let's point out those gaps where the evidence doesn't exist. This really was an attempt to do that and to provide a document that's completely evidence-based and doesn't rely on the voice of a few experts. And so the document is written by scores of authors. The methodology was such that an author would do an initial pass of the literature, create a document draft, and then in an anonymous way, that would be reviewed by another expert and then reviewed by another expert sequentially, as some of the other evidence-based reviews with recommendations have been done in the journal. It really created a robust discussion where people could say what they wanted to about the literature and in a really honest way. And so we think that that's a huge plus, a huge benefit to this document. Now, what it isn't, however, is what we call a clinical practice guideline. That is an even more robust methodology. And so it differs from kind of these, I would say, an expert opinion consensus statement. It's not that. This is a very, very systematic, robust, evidence-based approach. But it's also not a clinical practice guideline, which would go to the next level. And I think when people see the document, they'll realize that trying to turn this into a clinical practice guideline isn't really possible in many areas because we just don't have a sufficiently robust body of evidence to really go to that next step. So we make recommendations, but we don't go to the next level of really creating a practice guideline.
Well, I really congratulate you on taking our specialty to the next level by creating ICAR, a document like this. It's been very badly needed, and the work I know that it took you and countless authors, but I go back to you, the work that you did, Richard, in terms of leading this from the start and bringing it to fruition is outstanding. Congratulations to you, Richard.
Well, thank you, Tim. I mean, it took a few hours, it's fair, but I have to say that really a worldwide group of scores of authors that really approached this with great passion and honesty and integrity, and I am really happy with the way the whole thing turned out. It turned out better than I had hoped, and I hope that it'll value to our providers, our colleagues, and certainly our patients.
Well, as we start to get more feedback, as it's available to folks out there, when will it be available to everybody, Richard?
We're looking at publication here early 2016.
Great. And as that feedback comes back and discussions are generated, maybe I'll have you back on the podcast so that we can talk about some of the discussions that you and I have perhaps not thought of. And certainly I imagine you and I could talk about this for the rest of the day if we wanted to. Richard, again, thank you very much for joining me. I'll see you soon somewhere in the world. And
my pleasure, Tim. I look forward to it.
Great. And thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll see you the next time.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. It was directed, edited, and coordinated by Joe Troiano, with voiceover by Anne-Marie Alvarez and music by Alex Ramsdell. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or the sponsors.